Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, black women are underrepresented in elected office compared to the overall U.S. population. We'll talk to the leader of a group trying to change that. Now, Dane County Judge Josanne Reynolds ruled yesterday that the state must hold elections for two empty seats in the state legislature. Governor Walker had opted not to hold special elections to fill the seats of Republican lawmakers, former Senator Frank Lissay of DePere and former Representative Keith Ripp of Lodi. Both lawmakers left to work for Walker's administration. Originally, the governor argued that the elections would be too costly for taxpayers and said the newly elected lawmakers wouldn't be in office long enough anyway, given the elections coming up in November. But subsequent lawsuits contend that the lack of representation at the state capitol infringes on the rights of voters. And today, Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald of Juneau said he wants a bill put in place to block these special elections. WPR Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson joins us with the latest. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, Rob.
Well, we just talked to you a little yesterday. There have been developments since then, starting with Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald. What's he saying?
Well, he came out today and talked to reporters and said that we don't know exactly what he wants to do, but we know that he doesn't like this idea of potentially being forced to have special elections in the 42nd Assembly District and the 1st State Senate District in late May, early June, and then come back and hold elections for them again in November.
Let's give a listen to Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald.
What Republicans are doing is saying, listen, we need to take a look at what are the logistics now of the elections and how would they be carried out by the elections board, and does it make sense? And right now it doesn't make sense. I don't think a clerk would agree that this is going to make sense.
So what would have to happen now? The Senate is out of session, right? And the Assembly's in, as we talked about the other day, an extraordinary session. What would have to happen to pass a bill quickly to block these elections?
Well, as quickly as they could call that extraordinary session for the last stuff that they did, they could call another one, or the governor could call a special session, theoretically. You know, they can come back kind of whenever they want. Even if it's not in their regular calendar, they can always find the legislature a way to come back in some kind of a session to deal with a bill like this, if the votes are there.
Even if the votes were there, I mean, this is a judge saying this is a constitutional right to be represented. There could be a legal challenge to the legislature saying the legislature can't overrule a constitutional right if they can get judges to agree with that.
Yeah, it gets pretty thorny. It sounds like the first path that Fitzgerald would like to see is some kind of a court stay that blocks the judge's ruling. And, you know, but if that doesn't happen, then he's talking about looking to the legislature. So essentially he's saying that he would like to block this ruling the law requires these elections to be held. But if that law is not blocked, that is, if the court system says this judge made a good decision, then Fitzgerald is talking about changing the law to block these elections.
I want to give a listen to one of the plaintiffs in the case, Alvin Meyer, talking about the lawsuit over these special elections.
Is the view that the role of legislators so insignificant that we don't need one for a year? I just don't comprehend that, even what was the purpose here. Somebody quits, resigns, moves on. Why not fill their job? We're either saying that the role of a state senator is important or we're not.
And the judge seemed to agree with that argument.
Yeah, I mean, and Alvin Meyer was pretty happy with that ruling because without some kind of action from the court, the governor has said that he's not going to call special elections, and that would leave that first state Senate district where Alvin Meyer lives vacant for more than a year, and that hasn't happened in Wisconsin before. So the judge said basically that the laws regarding special elections are pretty clear, and that if it occurs before the second Tuesday in May in an election year, the governor shall call a special election. The governor is saying that because these vacancies happened in December of last year, he does not have to call a special election. But the judge said, well, if you follow that through to its kind of logical conclusion, she used the word absurd, because she's saying that you could have somebody leave the legislature in May, for example, and of this year. Or, you know, we could use the example of somebody could leave the legislature today and the governor would have to call a special election for that seat, but he would not have to have called one under his rationale for the ones from that last December.
And now some Republicans in the legislature are attacking the judge, saying that she had a liberal bias, Robin Voss, Assembly Speaker, among them. Other people pointed out this is a Walker appointee, this judge. What's the personal back and forth over the judge here?
Yeah, she was appointed by Governor Scott Walker in 2014. So you have not, I mean, he hasn't really been interviewed on this to my knowledge, but you haven't heard the governor out there saying that she's an activist. You did hear Assembly Speaker Robin Voss call her an activist judge almost, you know, it was just moments after the ruling had been issued. And he said that he had not read the ruling yet. That's a pretty common claim from Wisconsin Republicans when laws have been blocked in Dane County Circuit Court. A lot of those have gone up to be upheld by conservatives in the state Supreme Court. In this instance, you did see the chief judge that governs the Dane County Circuit Court come out and tell Speaker Voss in a letter pretty firmly, you know, I don't respect the I don't care for the tone, and, you know, it disrespects an independent branch of government here.
Well, we're watching to see what lawmakers and the governor and the attorney general do next. Sean, thanks a lot for joining us.
You're welcome.
That's Sean Johnson, Capitol Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Now, these kinds of lawsuits on special elections are few and far between. That means the state may be breaking some new legal ground here. Scott Gordon is an associate editor for WisContext. He's been writing extensively about the special elections process in the state. Scott, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Well, in my limited understanding of the legal system, Scott, I know judges, they want to look for precedent when they want to rule on a case. You looked at the precedent on lawsuits related to special elections. What's out there?
Really not a whole lot. You know, even if you look at the things that the plaintiffs in Wisconsin's special elections lawsuit have filed, you know, you don't really see a whole lot that relates directly to the special elections law in Wisconsin. And then, you know, in kind of federal jurisprudence, and I spent a bit of time, you know, bothering election law specialists and whatnot, and there isn't necessarily a whole lot there either. You know, of course, there's lots of cases and rulings out there that, you know, affirm things like one person, one vote, and you know, this kind of fundamental right to choose your representatives in government, but not a whole lot that digs in on some of the hairier questions that, you know, a really state-specific special elections dispute would raise.
And yeah, last when we talked to you, you mentioned that special elections, they're not rare. They happen, you know, fairly often. Special election lawsuits, not so much.
Right. And I mean, they do happen at state levels. And, you know, there have been a fair number of lawsuits where you know, Republican voters and activists have sued Democratic governors, including in New York State. And it's kind of funny, if you look back at some of those debates, they're like this little, almost this complete reversal of what we have now, where people on the Republican side are making a lot of the same points that Democrats in Wisconsin are making right now.
And Democrats making the opposite point. So as judges look at this, as people have been arguing it in this particular case, are they just what, arguing by analogy to other voting rights?
Well, not really. I think the really central dispute in this case is about the reading of state law, you know, and there's some other arguments beside that. But, you know, essentially what the judge in the Dane County judge in this case has said is that, look, the law plainly says this, and that's what the plaintiffs are arguing. You know, the Walker's argument is to kind of try and split hairs and say, because of the timing that these seats became vacant, that he has an out to not call special elections. But that, you know, clearly isn't convincing the judge, and, you know, it's clearly it's kind of tough to parse when you look at just the plain language of the statute.
Now, when you looked at those cases in New York, did judges ultimately say, yeah, you got to have a special election?
They did. And, you know, in some cases, they ended up being able to have it at the sort of delayed date that they wanted to, you know, contiguous with the November regularly scheduled election, the way that Walker wants to do here. And there's always that issue of you're trying to get the government to do something in a really short window of time that just by nature is likely to run out unless you can get things really fast-tracked and get the judge to see it your way.
And you looked to see if the U.S. Supreme Court had given any guidance on special election lawsuits. What did you find out there?
Not a whole lot. Again, you know, it's a weird combination of state and federal law, and especially when you're at the state legislative level, you know, state laws vary a lot more and get a lot more specific. You know, when it's a congressional election, there's a bit more of a, you know, federal standard to kind of be applied. But, you know, there's always going to be kind of this hairy mixture of federal and state specific things at work.
So when it comes to the internal workings of state law, SCOTUS don't care for the most part?
Well, I don't know about that. It's more just that, you know, I couldn't find, and you know, unless I've overlooked something, or the you know, elections law folks that I talked with are overlooking something, I really couldn't find something where the Supreme Court kind of weighed in on something that's really directly applicable here. And you know, there's nothing the plaintiff's lawyers are citing that really is either from that level.
And did you write that there's also something going on in Michigan that's in the same ballpark?
Yeah, there's a couple of things. There's a state legislative seat and a congressional seat, John Conyers' former seat, that the governor there, Rick Snyder, not unlike Walker here, kind of wants to wait until the November election to fill, which will, you know, lead to relatively long vacancies.
So after this case is resolved, however it's resolved, we'll have at least a little bit of precedent for the next time, if there is a next time.
Right. The next time it happens in Wisconsin, at least, and just as other states' cases aren't much help to us here, it might not be that much help here to people in other states.
Scott, thanks a lot for putting this in context for us.
Thank you, Rob.
Scott Gordon is an associate editor for WisContext. You could read more about the legal precedents in Wisconsin special elections, or lack of same, at wiscontext.org. A new report argues that black women are underrepresented in elected office nationwide. The report comes from Higher Heights for America, a national organization aimed at encouraging black women to run for office. According to the report, black women make up more than 7% of the U.S. population, but account for less than 5% of all elected positions. That's at the state and federal level. The report also finds that 2018 midterm elections could see some changes. Glinda Carr is co-founder of Higher Heights for America. Glinda, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we've seen numbers in recent elections showing that black women are very politically active. They're more likely to vote, I think, than any other group in the United States, but they're not represented in elected office. Can you talk about the different numbers?
Sure. Yeah. So every year we partner with the Center for American at Rutgers. They're the holder of, decades of research about women in elected office. And we thought it was important, as we started our organization 6 years ago, that we needed to create a baseline. So where are black women in American politics? The 23 million black women in this country are underrepresented and underserved. But what we've seen over the last decade is a steady increase in the number of black women running and the number of black women running. So in 2016, if you want to look at that frame, you know, when you had a woman running for the highest office, and on November 8th of that year, you know, people were anticipating that there was going to be this break in the glass ceiling. That didn't happen. When I woke up the day after the election, I was in Cleveland, Ohio. I saw two things, though, that wasn't the main head story. Black women broke through on the ballot and at the polls. So 94% of black women voted to move this country forward. But we also elected the largest number of women of color serving in Congress, including the largest number of black women in serving, the largest number of black women serving in Congress, including sending the second black woman to ever serve in the U.S. Senate, in the U.S. Senate Senator Kamala Harris from California. We also elected the largest number of black women serving in state legislatures in this country, including electing the first black woman to serve in the Kentucky legislature in 20 years. In 2014, there were only one black woman serving as a mayor of a major city. We now have five. And in May, when LaToya Cantrell in New Orleans is sworn in, we will have six. So there's major gains that have made, but there still are barriers of why women, and particularly black women, struggle to not only consider to run for office, but have the resources and the tools needed to be able to run, win, and serve.
Can you talk about some of those barriers, Glinda, facing black women as they think about running for office?
Yeah, our full report, again, that we do with the Center for American Women in Politics, pulls from a variety of research papers that have been done over the last couple of years. So, like, you know, women in general, raising money is a barrier. But for African-American women, that becomes a larger barrier. In addition, women are often not encouraged to run for office. Research points to that Black women are oftentimes discouraged from running for office and struggle to navigate gatekeepers. The Center for American Progress last year, Judith Warren put out some great research talking about gatekeepers and how, you know, our local, state, and national political structures often create barriers for women considering running for office. So we are excited at Higher Heights about being the political home formed by Black women. We've launched last year a webinar series that allows women just thinking about running for office to log on a Tuesday evening at 7 o'clock in the comfort of their home to just start exploring what are the tools you need to either be more politically engaged. It may be, you know, my best friend who is just looking to be a little more engaged outside of just voting, to someone that is seriously thinking about running for office, to a woman currently running for office who are looking for tools for her to be more successful in her journey.
One thing that struck me in your report, you mentioned mayors of big cities, you mentioned members of Congress and Senate. There's never been a Black woman as governor in this country.
Yeah, and actually, if you look at that, there's actually only been 12 Black women ever elected in statewide offices. We currently have three serving, two lieutenant governors, the lieutenant governor in Kentucky, the lieutenant governor in New Jersey, and the state treasurer in Connecticut. So what's shocking is that people assume that there has been a Black woman elected governor. And in our 241-year history, there never has been. But there is a opportunity in Georgia this year to elect the first Black woman governor in the candidate of Stacey Abrams. And for us at Higher Heights, we've got to create pipelines for a Black woman to run from school board to city council to state legislature. It's the pipeline to create more opportunities for Black women to run statewide, and frankly, for me to envision a Black woman creating a pathway for her to run to be president of the United States.
We're talking to Glenda Carr with the group Higher Heights for America, talking about Black women in politics. By the numbers, underrepresented in pretty much any office you can think of. Glenda, let's talk about now the election 2018. What are you seeing out there when it comes to Black women running for office?
Well, this is the 50th anniversary of the late Congresswoman Shirley Chisholm's run in election to Congress, catapulting her to be the first Black woman ever seated in that body. So 50 years later, you know, Black women are still, you know, looking to expand the representation at decision-making tables. She once said, if there isn't a seat at the table, bring your folding chair. I think the 21st century model to that is twofold. Let's define the makeup of that decision-making table, and in some aspects, challenging to claim your seat at the table. That being said, you know, there are a record number of women running for office, and there's a record number of Black women running for office. There's a database that was launched right after the Alabama Senate elections. It's called Black Women in Politics, and they've been tracking through a crowdsourcing model Black women that are running for office up and down the ballot, and that database has over 500 Black women who have identified that they're running for office. So it's an exciting time, but we also have to recognize there's a lot of work to still be done to effectively encourage Black women to run, prepare them to run, and then for us, it's about ensuring that once elected, that they have the support and environment for them to push policies that that can move Black, you know, Black women's issues, their community issues, and frankly, our nation's issues forward.
You mentioned the race for governor in Georgia. Are there other particular races you have your eye on around the country?
People may have been following Lauren Underwood, who's running in Illinois for Congress. A little-known candidate. She's a registered nurse. She's in her 30s. Worked for the Obama administration, went back home, decided to run for office, you know, running in a district that doesn't look like her. I believe the district is just a little over 3% African-American. You know, for us is, you know, it is about electing qualified candidates regardless of their background. And this past Tuesday, she actually won that primary election with 60% of the vote in a seven-way race. So we're very excited about not only more diverse candidates stepping off the sidelines, but the fact that she, you know, proved that she was able to mount a successful campaign. Lucy McBeth is running in Georgia. She is a gun violence activist. She was Troy Davis's mother. So again, talking about this discussion around gun control and gun violence, that you have activists considering, you know, stepping off the sidelines to run for office. Aja Brown, I think everyone's going to be following this race in California. Aja Brown, who's the mayor of Compton, and actress Stacey Dash are running for a same seat in California. So lots of opportunities. If people want to follow our work, they should follow us online with our hashtag Black Women Lead, or at Higher Heights. And you can find about the latest interesting statistics and data points about Black women running for office, and more importantly, to be engaged in a conversation about how do we actually truly harness and unleash the organizing power of Black women from the voting booth to elected office.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Glenda, are you hoping that success breeds success as Black women see other Black women running and maybe winning? It'll inspire more of them to do the same?
Absolutely. Again, research actually points to a role modeling effect. It is not by coincidence that over the last couple election cycles, you continue to see more Black women running for office. When we see the possibilities that exist, it inspires more women to run for office. My favorite quote from Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms' victory speech when she won back in December 2017, she said, "For all the little girls who can't see past their circumstance, I want you to know that Black girl magic is real."
We'll leave it there, Glenda. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Glenda Carr, co-founder of Higher Heights for America, a national organization that works on getting Black women into politics. She joined us to talk about their new report looking at the number of Black women running for office in 2018. It's maple syrup season here in Wisconsin. When we think about syrup, pancakes might be the first thing we think of, but our next guest says we can add that maple flavor to a whole lot of other dishes too. Casey Elsass was born and raised in New Hampshire, where maple syrup's part of the culture. He's the founder of Bushwick Kitchen, a New York-based company that makes flavorful sauces, including a maple syrup collection. He's the author of a cookbook on maple syrup from Short Stack Editions, which is a series of small-format cookbooks, each focusing on a different ingredient. He joins us now for Food Friday. Casey, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, before we start cooking, I mean, maple syrup's big here in Wisconsin. Tell us about the role maple syrup has played in your life.
Yeah, I mean, coming from New England, maple syrup's just such a part of the culture, particularly this time of year. I don't know if you guys have anything like this, but we have a great tradition called the Sugar on Snow Supper, which is kind of the celebration of the maple crop that culminates in bowls of snow or shaved ice, and you pour hot maple syrup on top of it and lay it on top of donuts or just wrap it around your finger. So it's just really, it's a very nostalgic part of my childhood and my experience growing up.
And that stuck with you. Cooking in New York now, maple syrup is still big for you.
Yeah. Well, in New York too, we actually have a pretty healthy and thriving, maple production. Vermont is a huge producer. I think that's what a lot of people think of when they think of American maple syrup. But New York is actually right behind Vermont in terms of production.
Now, not everybody starts off their syrup experience with the real stuff, the real maple syrup. Why should people spend the extra money and get real maple syrup as opposed to the, you know, maple flavored sugar stuff?
Yeah, if you have anything in your fridge that begins with the word log, aunt, or Mrs., throw it out, walk away from that. Real maple syrup is actually a very different experience in terms of viscosity and in terms of flavor. Those sorts of grocery store maple syrups are actually corn syrup with what they call a maple flavor, but I actually think tastes nothing like maple syrup. Obviously, I'm very particular about this stuff, but I just think every kitchen should have a quality bottle of independently produced maple syrup right along with your olive oil, with your vinegar. You should think of it not just as something to pour on pancakes, but as a real ingredient to be used in cooking, and really play around with it. It's actually a very complex flavor profile that can be used in a lot of different things.
Right, and that's a lot of what your book is about. You do have pancakes in there and syrup, but you are making the case that we should be thinking of maple syrup in our entrees, our drinks, our desserts, everything. Talk about the flexibility of maple syrup.
Maple syrup really can enliven a cocktail, particularly with darker brown liquors. Those flavors really play off of each other really well. But what I was most surprised by when I was testing things, and I really went in on the testing. I even tried maple syrup on pasta, all sorts of things that didn't end up in the book for good. Yeah. But something that really surprised me was seafood and maple syrup actually go really well together. I have a recipe in the book for a maple poached lobster roll, but even types of wild caught fish, salmon especially, works really well with a maple glaze on top.
Yeah, what goes into making a glaze that we'd put on, say, a salmon kind of fish?
You know, because maple is so sugary already, it can just be applied directly onto the protein. So even if you're barbecuing, it gives you this really nice lacquered, delicious crust on top of pork, or a really nice cut of steak actually can use some maple syrup on it. And it adds a really good sweetness and a really nice caramelization.
Casey Alsass is with us on Food Friday. He's helping us cook with maple syrup. He's written a book of recipes from Short Stack Editions. It's called Maple Syrup. And let's get into one of your recipes that you've shared with us. We have this at WPR.org/Food Friday and the Ideas Network Facebook page, Poutine with Spicy Maple Bacon. For starters, for people who haven't eaten poutine, tell us about the dish and its origins a little bit.
So poutine comes from Quebec, the Canadian province, particularly Montreal. That's kind of the signature dish of Montreal. And it's a really delicious, disgusting mashup of French fries and gravy covered in cheese curds, which I'm sure you in Wisconsin are very familiar with.
We can find them around here. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's just, it's really known as like a great late night, after knocking back a ton of Molson, a big bowl of poutine is just what you need to go to bed happy. So my recipe for it includes spicy maple bacon on top. And as I was saying before, maple syrup and meat are really just so happy together. And the maple syrup on top of the bacon adds a really nice crispiness to it, a sweetness to it. And actually, if you're a really big fan of maple syrup, I would encourage you to just pour a little drizzle over the completed dish of poutine too, because that meat gravy with a maple hit is so excellent.
Well, I think you're on to something here, because we've got pretty near full phone lines, and I never gave the number, which is 800-642-1234 if you want to join in. We'll go to Jeremy in Racine. Jeremy, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just kind of want to give a shout-out for Racine Nature Center. They got a Root River Bend Nature Center. Every Sunday from 9 to 2, they host a breakfast with pure maple syrup that they harvest right there on the Nature Center. So you're able to go have a nice breakfast and then walk the trails, and they'll show you the process of how they collect it and things like that. So it's really cool. It's pretty cheap. Kids are free. It runs probably till end of April, something like that. But it helps you support the local nature center and things like that. And it's pretty cool.
Jeremy, thank you so much. That sounds great. Is freshness an issue when it comes to maple syrup? Do we want that fresh tapped stuff or as close to as possible, Casey?
Well, actually, I think what a lot of people don't realize is the ratio from maple sap to maple syrup is actually a 40-to-1 ratio. So it takes 40 gallons of sap to get 1 gallon of maple syrup. So after all that boiling, freshness is kind of a moot point.
I guess so, yeah.
But I will say, I grew up, we had a similar thing in New Hampshire. Our local was called Parker's Maple Barn, and that was one of my favorite parts of spring, was going there during sugaring season and sitting at the picnic tables eating unlimited pancakes and maple syrup that had just come out of the processing tank. That's a really special experience.
That sounds fantastic. Thanks for that call. We'll go next to Dave in Augusta. Dave, hi.
Hello. want to share a quick story. A friend and I, about 35 years ago, drove up from Madison area to Hayward. And on the way up, we came through a little town called Radisson, and we were hungry. We drove all night long. We stopped at a little tavern that served breakfast, and we had scrambled eggs and sausage, along with walleye and maple syrup. And we mixed the walleye. We put the walleye under the maple syrup.
Wow.
It was absolutely wonderful. Just something that you'll never forget.
That sounds great, Dave. A couple things there, Casey. First of all, you mentioned that seafood earlier, walleye going great with the maple syrup, huh?
Yeah, that's a great idea. And actually, funnily enough, I think eggs and maple syrup are really great together.
Yeah, that was the second thing I was going to bring up. In the book, you really make a point that there's two kinds of people. People who want maple syrup hitting their eggs and people who don't.
Yeah, I always love that happy accident when it spilled off of my pancakes and onto my eggs, but I know that's something a lot of people get a little iffy about. In the book, I take that to an extreme, and I have a recipe for maple poached eggs, which is my idea of heaven, maybe somebody's nightmare. But I think scrambled eggs with maple syrup are A-okay by me.
And there's a clip of Twin Peaks I should have pulled. I just thought about it when Dale Cooper is talking about how he loves when he's got ham and pancakes, and he loves the taste of the maple syrup collides.
Yep.
Collapsed with the ham. So those breakfast-type meats are going to be great with the maple syrup.
Absolutely.
Well, thanks a lot for that call. Let's take another caller. Neil is with us in Appleton. Neil, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What do you got for us, Neil?
Equal measures of pure maple syrup and stone-ground mustard.
Really?
Slathered on your salmon and bake 350, 20, 25 minutes.
And that stone-ground mustard and syrup. And, Neil, it's a good combination?
Oh, absolutely.
All right. So mustard and syrup, that, I got to say, Casey, is not a flavor pairing I would have put together. What do you think?
I love it. I think Neil's thinking about it in exactly the right way. Maple syrup is a very sweet product, but it's so welcoming to other flavor profiles. So the acidity and the texture of the mustard, plus the salmon, plus the syrup, I could see that being an incredible pairing.
Thanks a lot for that call, Neil. It is Food Friday. We're talking to Casey Elsass, founder of Bushwick Kitchen in New York. He's talking about maple syrup. He's written about it in a cookbook. It's the Short Stack Editions Maple Syrup Cookbook. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you tap and make your own maple syrup? Do you cook with it? Do you use it in maybe unexpected ways, as our guest is making the case for? Do you have an idea you want to share? Call 800-642-1234. Or did you just finish tapping? Are you boiling it down as you're listening? Call 800-642-1234 or leave a comment on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up a conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Casey Elsass is with us talking about his cookbook, Short Stack Editions Maple Syrup. Casey's the founder of Bushwick Kitchen in New York. He is with us on Food Friday for advice on cooking with maple syrup. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Find a couple of Casey's recipes while you're there. Back to your calls. Tom is with us in Janesville. Tom, hi.
Hi. Hey, listen, I would like to give you a recipe for what's called sweet meat, which I learned from a very close Ojibwe Indian friend of mine. And it basically amounts to chopping a couple of large onions and putting them in a Dutch oven, put a bison or buffalo roast in there. Beef will work, but bison is better. And then pour in enough maple syrup to just cover it and then simmer it all afternoon over an open fire or in the oven. And it is unbelievably delicious, and you will debate which is better, the meat or the onions. It's just awesome.
Tom, I just got to ask. I mean, people might hear that and think it's going to be too sweet. It's not too sweet?
No.
All right. Thank you so much. So bison, onions, maple syrup, and cook them, slow cook them for a long time, Casey. Do you have anything like that?
You know, bison's not really native to the Northeast, so that's not a meat I'm familiar with. But I think that's a great idea. I actually, in the book, played around with the idea of a slow-cooked pot of baked beans with a ton of onions in there. And I do think like a root vegetable slow cooked in maple syrup's great. And then I definitely advocate for cooking all types of meat in maple syrup.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go next to Harry in Rock Falls. Harry, hi.
Hello. Hey, I'm boiling sap as we speak.
No kidding.
So, yeah. What I like to do is, as it's boiling and it's getting down close, I will scoop out a little cup of it and add about a third of nice Caribbean rum to it, and it is quite unbelievable.
That's it, just two ingredients, rum and almost completely processed maple syrup?
Yep, and if you have maple syrup, you can make it just like go and buy half syrup and half water and then just nuke it for a while and then add a third amount of rum. And it's actually too good.
Harry, good luck with this year's batch of maple syrup. Yeah, talk a little more about the cocktails you have in the book, Casey.
Yeah, well, actually, Harry's pretty close to making a daiquiri. When we think of daiquiris, I think we think of the like TGI Fridays, like whipped cream blender daiquiri. But the original daiquiri was rum, a sweetener, and lime juice shaken in a cocktail shaker. And so in my book, actually, I have a recipe for rum. It's two parts rum, one part maple syrup, one part lime juice. And then I actually threw a couple sage leaves in there, too, because I just think the earthiness of those leaves really round out the drink in a nice way. But I am in love with the idea of just pouring rum in hot maple syrup.
All right. Well, thanks so much. Enjoy your cocktails tonight out there. We'll go next to Eric in Lake Tomahawk. Hi.
Well, hi there. Can you hear me?
I sure can. What do you want to tell us about?
One of my favorite things when I was a little bit younger, we would always do drumsticks from Grounds. We'd save them up and paste those. We make our own syrup so we can afford it. And you take that to the family get-together, and it disappears real fast.
Drumsticks from Grouse, you said?
You bet. Well, there you probably call them partridge.
Okay. Thank you so much. So with poultry, Casey, any ideas for maple syrup and poultry recipes?
Yeah, I love how in tune everybody is with this book, actually. I have a recipe for maple miso wings, which are actually chicken wings, but I think Grouse drumsticks would be great, too. But I found maple on chicken or any sort of poultry is really great. But I really liked what happened when I added a little more complexity with the miso, which just gives it this really nice, savory, umami flavor to it that really reflects the savoriness of the meat. But I think maple and soy sauce would also have a similar effect there, too. But yeah, totally right on the money with that one.
Thanks for that call. It's Food Friday. We're cooking with maple syrup with Casey Elsass. Back to your calls now. Stella is on the line in Sturgeon Bay. Stella, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to give people a heads up. We had a many years source of maple syrup, and then we lost it. And so we went to the grocery store and bought samples of all the local maple syrups. And some of them, there was one of them that just tasted wonderful, like what we had been getting. And some of them just tasted basically kind of like water, very watery, a very inferior flavor. So we hunted down the producer, and they explained to us that what happens is some producers now, in order to speed up the process, they use reverse osmosis for removing the water from the sap, and they don't boil it. And you need to boil the sap in order to caramelize the sugars and get that wonderful maple flavor. And so you need, I recommend to people that you find, that you get to know your producer and find out whether they are boiling their sap down to syrup or if they're using reverse osmosis.
Stella, thanks a lot for sharing that. Casey, is that something you've run into?
I've heard about reverse osmosis as a way to do a first pass at clearing out impurities, but I've never heard of someone doing it as the full process. And Stella's totally right. That just wouldn't give you the heating of the starches in the sap is what gives it the dark color, but also that very sweet, rich flavor. So doing it that way, actually, I say that's not maple syrup.
All right, Stella, thanks for the heads up. We'll go next to Tom in Madison. Tom, hi.
Hello. I've noticed that I want to make two comments. One is that people think that maple syrup is incredibly expensive, and it's not true, because when you compare it to the store-bought high fructose corn syrup varieties, it is much sweeter. And when you use it, you can use it in dribs and drabs rather than smearing it all over. That's one comment. My other comment is you should try dill pickles dipped in maple syrup. It is absolutely fabulous.
I'm seeing some faces made in the studio here, Tom, but thanks for that. But that's that combining it with an acid, the vinegar and the pickle, Casey, so that's so crazy it just might work.
Yeah, and actually in these sugar on snow suppers that I was talking about before, when the dessert course comes, you're served a bowl of snow, a jar of hot maple syrup, a few plain donuts, and actually a side of dill pickles.
No kidding.
Yeah, and the way I've always thought of those is they're a really nice palate cleanser when the sugar just starts really coating your mouth and you sort of need a refresh button to start again. But I've actually never thought to just dip one right into the maple syrup.
You're on to something, Tom. Thanks. We'll go next to Megan in Waukesha. Megan, hi.
Hi.
What'd you want to tell us about, Megan?
Yeah, I actually, I'm a vegetarian, so I don't eat any of those lovely meats that you were talking about. But they make a tofurkey loaf around, like, Thanksgiving time, and I actually, like, douse it in maple syrup, and it's awesome. So it goes good with tofu, too.
So wait, do you douse the tofu or tofurkey in the syrup and then, what, yeah, bake it or fry it, or do you cook it and then
I
put it on the syrup?
I kind of use it as the base. I mix it with the gravy that you're given in the little box that it comes in, and I kind of use it mixed with the maple syrup as a base.
Maple gravy tofurkey, Casey. Do you have? I think you've got some veggie stuff in there, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think we all know that vegetables and maple syrup are great together, particularly root vegetables like a squash or carrots, really good roasted in maple. What I would actually encourage people to play around with is making a dressing or a vinaigrette using the maple syrup. And especially with our sort of winter, early spring bitter greens, a really sweet, acidy dressing is a really nice contrast to that.
Thanks a lot for that call, Megan. We're just about out of time, so sorry, remaining callers. I wanted to get to the other recipe we have at WPR.org/Food Friday, Casey. Maple flavor. Now, I love me a good whoopie pie. You've got malted maple whoopie pies. Talk about what goes into that and the flavor.
Yeah, the idea of that actually started as a maple and chocolate malted milkshake. But in sort of developing those flavors and those ideas, I thought a whoopie pie is the best vessel for those flavors. So if you really like that malty flavor, the cookie part of the whoopie pie is a chocolate malt. And then the filling is a maple marshmallow filling. And everything together in one big bite is just so, so good.
That sounds fantastic. Casey, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you.
That was Casey Elsass, founder of Bushwick Kitchen, a New York-based company that makes flavorful sauces, including, yes, a maple syrup collection. He's the author of the cookbook Short Stacks Editions Maple Syrup. We've been cooking with maple syrup and making beverages and more. And there's still time for you to share your favorite maple syrup recipes, your favorite things to do with it, and how your tapping season is going and boiling season is going this year. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page and find two of the recipes Casey shared with us, the poutine with spicy maple bacon, sounds pretty good, and those malted maple whoopie pies he was just telling us about. Again, that's all at the Ideas Network Facebook page. If you spend any time online or texting or snapping or whatever, you're going to run into a lot of slang and abbreviations. And that ranges from the classic LOLs and OMGs to a huge and growing list of abbreviations that are hard to keep track of. Some people don't like these new developments in the language. I think it's kind of a lazy way to communicate, or maybe frustrating because it's hard to keep up with all the new things the kids are coming up with. And I say, okay. Because on this day in 1839, it was the first recorded instance of the phrase, okay, being used in print. It was printed in the Boston Morning Post. We found that on the History Channel website earlier today. And they shared the leading theory about where OK came from. And this is a long-running dispute, and there's a lot of ideas. This seems like probably the right one, according to scholars. 1830s, right, back in the 1830s, the youth culture, they used a lot of slang, intentional misspellings, and abbreviations. Kids those days, am I right? So OK was an abbreviation for the phrase OLL, O-L-L, correct, like the word correct, but with a K. So that was an intentional slang misspelling of the phrase all correct, all correct, shortened to okay. So it's in the paper here, and then it gets heavily used in a presidential campaign, and that story gets really complicated. I'm not going to go into it here. It caught on, and okay became one of the most commonly recognized phrases in the world. So that annoying slang you see today might bring the world together in another 180 years or so. This is Central Time.